Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon if you're joining us from Europe. We're here on another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We're recording on November 12th, 2020 at about 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Today, we're hosting Global Ship Lease and their management team, including George Yacouras, the Executive Chairman, Ian Weber, CEO. We have Tassos Paripoulos, CFO, and Tom Lister, the Chief Commercial Officer. So we have their whole team with us today. We're going to discuss the container ship markets and the recent recovery in rates, the improvement in charter backlogs, and what Global Ship Lease is doing in this market, and also some more company-specific things like their upcoming refinancing due in November 22. So with that said, good morning, good afternoon, and welcome to the Global Ship Lease team.
Hi, Edward.
Hello, thank you.
Just some disclosures before we begin. I currently have a long position in Global Ship Lease, so keep that in mind. Nothing you hear on the call today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations in any form. Keep in mind as well, this is being recorded on the morning of 12 November. So if you're listening at a later date, just make sure you get those latest disclosures. Again, welcome, gentlemen. Let's jump right into it, and let's talk about the container ship market strength. I mean, it's been incredible. I've been optimistic on containers, I think, since July and August, but the duration and level magnitude of the strength has surprised me here. What is driving this primarily, and how long do we think this can last?
Well, if I may start with this, and then Tom also will join me. The market is really... The driver of the market really is fundamentals. First of all, the order book is at the lowest since the last 40 years. It's at 7.8%, and especially on the ships that really create the market, which is ships between, 2,500, 2,200, all the way up to 11,000. These are the more of the spot type ships that fix regularly. The order book for these ships, it's very, very low. It's like 1.5 or 2%, Tom would say. On the post-Panamax segment of this division of ships that I just met, which is around 5.5 to 11, the order book is zero, nothing. So we're in a unique situation with respect to supply of ships. Now, what has happened different, and it has turned the market into fire, is that the liner companies, due to COVID and by a big accident, they over reduced capacity. Like everybody was in a fear way, let's say, dictated by fear during the COVID. The beginning of the COVID, no one knew what's going to happen. So everybody took measures to control costs. Liner companies, ourselves, similar companies to us, we were all in the unknown. So we hit the brakes very hard to make sure that liquidity was preserved and so on and so forth. So liner companies in this respect, what they did was they reduced capacity. They reduced capacity in a very strong way, something that they have never done before in the history. The result was surprising to them, and surprising in a very pleasant way, as freight rates for containers went through the roof. So that has learned a lesson to the whole industry, that instead of chasing capacity and adding capacity, that was the norm over the last 15, 20 years, it's more profitable to control capacity rather than keep on ordering ships and adding capacity, trying to fight each other's market share. So this has been the case, and the results of the liner companies have been, you know, probably some of the best results they ever had, and as we speak, they continue to do that. So that is really what is driving the container ship market in essence. You know, the fact that there are not enough ships, there is demand, and liner companies are controlling the situation of oversupply, and they are making very serious profits. Having said that, COVID also helps. It's an unfortunate event, which we all want to finish, but the reality is that a lot of services due to lockdowns have stopped being offered. So people are spending more on purchases rather than services. So the consumers have shifted their consumption into goods, which obviously are carried by containers. That also has even given a further boost to the market, over and above the fundamental boost that the market should have. I don't know, Tom, if you want to add something.
Sure. All I would add, really, to what George has said is that in our quarterly earnings release, we provided data in the market section of our presentation on slides 8 through to 12. And that presentation is posted on our website, globalshiplease.com. And just to pick out a few of those data points to support what George has been saying, absolutely, the order book, it is at a 40-year low, 7.8%. And the order book for the mid-sized post-Panamax ships, upon which we're focused and which we believe represent the sweet spot of both operational flexibility and low costs and emissions per slot, is very close to zero. It's actually 0.1%, but effectively zero. And in terms of the earnings rebound that we've seen, to your point, Jay, that the rebound has been even stronger than you were expecting, and you were already bullish on container ships. Well, I would say it's even stronger than we were expecting too. And to give you some data points on that, post-Panamax rates are up by roughly double, 98% at the end of September versus where they were at the low point in the second quarter. Panamaxes are up by 138%. Again, end of September versus the low point in the second quarter, and even feeders, which have tended to flatline in recent years, have seen a remarkable uptick, and they are up 56% over the same period.
Yeah, significant improvements in the balances and utilization of those container ships. There's a lot of folks that are comparing the container ship rally and rates to kind of something like we saw in the tanker space, which of course was very rapid, very strong rates, but it only lasted for a couple months. Are there any near-term challenges to this market, stuff that could bring these rates crashing back down, or do you think there's more duration to this? And can you talk a little bit about sort of the charter durations? What sort of deals are you seeing? Are these 1 or 2 year deals? Are we seeing anything lengthier than that, or is this mostly short-term?
Well, I'll try to answer that in correlation to tankers. Tankers, it's always a very volatile market. This is a commodity, oil. This commodity, as we all know, is regulated by OPEC and others. So a lot of wild cards into this. And that's why you see tankers having a rally and then the rally finishes very fast and so on and so forth. Containers is a completely different story. Containers, it's a logistics business. It is the business that carries almost everything that is surrounding us when we look around, you know, from the smallest to the biggest things. So it's not really something that is going to go up and then go down very rapidly as it went up. Usually container ships do not have such movements anyway, historically. Now, the near-term challenges, surely containers may move things that consumers buy. So the only thing we would be afraid of would be if people stop buying goods. But I mean, that I think is something that anybody can give a guess whether it is possible or not. I would probably say not. We have seen the worst that, you know, our times, you know, I don't think anybody has ever had a pandemic that is alive today. So we have seen that horrible situation of a pandemic, and still the liner business went down for a couple of months and then back up even stronger. So, you know, boxes move everything, whether you call it medical supplies or food, you know, or furniture or things that people need during lockdowns and so on and so forth. So it is, you know, the movement of boxes, it's completely needed into our society, and it is such a primary need of people that it has nothing to do with tankers. Now, if you ask me, in the future, are we going to burn oil? It seems unlikely, you know, in the 10, 15 years from now. So tankers move oil. I don't know what does that mean for the future. But are we going to be having containers being moved around in 15, 20 years? Absolutely yes. There's no other way to move consumer goods. And as long as consumers are existing, boxes will be existing. These two go hand in hand. So that's with respect to the comparison between the two markets. Now, what are the risks to the market? Obviously, in every shipping market, an over-ordering of ships would be a risk. But even if tomorrow morning everybody started ordering container ships like crazy, it would take 2 years for all these orders to hit the market. Thankfully, there are two catalysts that stop people ordering. First one is the fact that container ships are the most expensive type of ship out there. I mean, it's a container ship costs similar size to each other, to compare apple to apple, about double the price of a bulkier, or 75% or 50% more than a tanker. So let's say, to put numbers, if a tanker costs 50 million, a bulkier costs 50 million, a container costs 100 million, and a tanker costs 75 million, as an example. So you cannot build ships today without knowing what the fuel of the future is, especially when these ships have to have a useful life of 25 years, and we do not know for sure in 15 years what will be the fuel that ships are going to be propelled with. So that's a very big challenge for anybody to order today, and a very big risk. So until this is clear and is resolved and the decision is being made, we will not see, I believe, you know, a massive order that could ruin this market. Tom, you want to add?
Sure. Yes, thank you. Thank you, George. I will. Really, just to underline some of the points that George has made. I mean, container shipping has been around since 1956, which is, what, 64, 65 years, and it has grown every single year of those 64 years, with the exception of one, which was back in the global financial crisis in 2009, and likely this year. But it's growth that tends to correlate with GDP growth, and after each downturn, certainly if we look at 2009 as an example, you see a very rapid and V-shaped rebound in volumes, which is what we're actually also seeing at the moment in 2020. And, you know, reiterating what George has said, the only time the industry has really got itself into difficulties has been as a result of over-ordering, oversupply. And I would add to the, you know, the issues that George has outlined, those being sort of propulsion technology uncertainty going forward, availability of capital. I would also add the fact that since the global financial crisis, there are now three mega alliances between the big liner operators, which has led to a much more disciplined approach to ordering. And that really, I would say, would go a long way to explain why the order book to fleet ratio, which back in 2007 was roughly 60%, math, to today, a 40-year low of 7.8%, which is really very modest if you assume that order book is going to deliver over the next 3 years or so. So I think the supply side challenge, which has been the principal historic challenge for the industry, is currently under control.
Yeah, significantly improved dynamics in the market, and hopefully we'll keep seeing that. I know there's a lot of skepticism in container ship markets, just because of, you know, some of the other things we've seen in other areas. Obviously, tankers much different, bulkers much different, but still they get lumped in. I think container ships maybe unfairly get lumped in to shipping as opposed to more so like logistics. You know, I've made the argument that, you know, container ships are more, have more in common with something like XPO logistics or even like UPS than they do with like dry bulk, right? I mean, completely different industries. But, you know, beyond that, let's focus a little bit. Let's turn back towards global ship lease in particular. There is a little bit of an overhang on the stock. You're not trading anywhere near your adjusted net asset value. And one of the things that might explain that is that November 22 bond. Your cost of interest is very, very high. I mean, if you compare your interest rates to what some of your peers are paying, whether it's, you know, Costa Maray or Danaos or other companies, unfairly, I think you're paying a very high interest rate. So what is the sort of an update or a reasonable timeline to getting that refinancing done? Because I feel like once you get that refinancing done, there's significant upside in the earnings and cash flow potential.
Jay, this is Ian. Refinancing that bond is a strategic priority of ours, but let's just step back a little bit. This is legacy GSL. This bond refinanced an earlier bond, which we issued in 2014. And at that time, due to loan to value constraints, high yield debt was the only debt instrument available to us. We were unable to borrow in the regular way bank senior secured lending market. Now, we're a totally different company from 2017 when we issued that second bond. We've merged with Poseidon with more than doubled the size of our fleet in terms of numbers of vessels, trebled the size of the fleet in terms of capacity. Our fleet on average is younger, larger, and better specified with a lower overall loan to value. Furthermore, with the massive improvements in the container ship market that that Tom and George have just been discussing, the range of debt finance that's available to us has increased. So we are looking to refinance this bond. It is opportunistic. As you noted, it's got 2 years to go. But if we can save 3 points of interest cost, then that's $7 or $8 million in the year, given the total amount of the bond that's outstanding. And you know, we believe that ought to be achievable with a mixture of maybe bank debt and mezzanine type finance, with a blended cost of 7, maybe 8%, but certainly less than the 10%. This is opportunistic, so we're taking our time to get it right and come up with the best refinancing package for our company.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see more progress on that going forward. I know initially there was a lot of optimism about refinancing that bond during 2020, but then, you know, COVID hit and that kind of threw a lot of those things off the rails. I've noticed you've had, you know, you have an ATM program for both your preferreds and for your baby bonds. The GSLB series preferreds and the GSLD is the symbol on the baby bonds for those listening. I noticed recently in the last quarter, you issued a little bit of preferred. It seemed to be a little higher cost, but around 9.5-10% yield. Is the thinking on that simply that you're using those preferreds to kind of pay back the bonds and you'd rather have preferred than debt? Is that kind of the thinking? And if so, you know, how large do you think the scope could be for like a preferred? Is it something that can go, you know, 10 or 20 million higher, or are we pretty much tapped out there?
You're right. It is just drip feeding additional capital into our balance sheet, and that facilitates the refinancing of the bond. So it's a great program, and on both of those instruments, the preferred and the baby bond D. And you know, we look to continue that. The capacity depends very much on how the market view us and how the instruments are trading. And I'm pleased to say that they're both trading extremely well at the moment. So all things equal, we should continue to add incremental amounts of capital to our balance sheet from this source. As I say, that this is with an objective of facilitating the refinancing. And then we'll have to think again about whether we continue with the programs to provide capital for growth, say.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. I think with GSL in particular, I mean, each company has their own catalyst and things to watch. I think with GSL in particular, it's really about refinancing those bonds, bringing those interest rates down, and there's a significant amount of value that can be unlocked once you turn that corner. And, you know, we're seeing lower cost interest rates available in today's market, but we're still seeing hesitancy, I think, on some of the banks and especially some of the more, I guess, like unsecured bonds and that sort of financing is a little bit harder to get going. What about dividends? Is that something that is, you know, is that kind of off the table until the refinancing is done? Is that still kind of the point of view?
Well, the dividend, we understand that is a very important issue for investors, and we are investors ourselves in the company, so we completely are aligned. And dividend at this stage with the bond in place, it's not something we are considering, as you know, there's a lot of cash flow that goes into the expensive bond. But once this is refinanced and we can ensure a dividend that is consistent, so a dividend that will stay, it is one of our priorities in our heads to initiate a dividend that is sustainable. Ian, if you want to add something that I didn't say.
No, I think that's a fair summary, George. The priority, as I've said, is to get this refinancing done. And then we understand the huge importance of dividends to reward the providers of our equity capital. We have ambitions to continue to develop the business. We know that we're going to need additional equity in due course. And the best efficient way of raising extra equity is to have a firm stock price, and a dividend would help to strengthen our stock price.
Yeah, I think investors want to know that, you know, with cash flows improving and the profile rebalancing, that, you know, they're going to see some benefit to that. And I think, you know, legacy, you talked about legacy GSL. If you look back in the past, when you had a dividend and you did, you know, totally different market, but when you had a dividend, of course, the shares traded much better. And I think that's true of many container ship stocks. If you look at kind of the highest trading ones in terms of multiples, I think Atlas Co. is probably the highest in terms of multiples, but Costa Maria is up there as well. They both have very steady dividends, and that's something that attracts investors. So hopefully we'll get there sooner than later. I know before COVID, we kind of thought it was like a mid-2020 type timeline. Maybe now it's more of like a mid-21 type timeline. But we're looking forward to that. Is there any potential? We talked about refinancing. We talked about dividends. Is there any potential for asset growth at this time, or is that have the assets already kind of increased in value?
No, the reality is that we do have a great deal flow, proprietary deal flow, and deals that are not coming into the market. So, yes, there is a potential for growth. The growth would have to be very careful and very accretive to shareholders. We do not believe in growth for the sake of growth, or, you know, to make the stock go up just because people read in the news that we grow, and then, you know, a couple of years later, you go for a Chapter 11 because you overgrown at the wrong time. No, there is a lot of possibilities for growth for us. The container market in general does not have a lot of players and not a lot of competition in values of ships, especially in the larger ships where it's our, let's say, preference, you know, post-Panamaxes. So I would say that, yes, once we're ready and we have dealt with our refinance, growth is something that we will begin to have, like we did a year ago, where we bought 7 ships in a year. There are such deals out there for us, and we will continue to take them, cherry-pick them, let's say, deals that make a lot of sense and a lot of good returns.
Yes, and just to add to that, Jay, at the moment there's a very interesting disconnect between what's happening in the earnings environment, where we're seeing rates go through the roof, as I mentioned earlier, and I'll come back to this with more specifics in a moment, and what's happening to values. And at the moment, although values have begun to improve, and tend to sort of correlate over time with charter rates, they haven't picked up. They're nowhere near up as far as earnings are in the sector. So that's clearly an interesting purchasing opportunity. And that's another impetus really for us to try to complete our refinancing, which is our strategic priority, as soon as possible so that we can get back in the growth path and pounce on some of these interesting deals. Now, on our earnings call on the 9th, we provided some insight on some additional charters that we had locked in, because our strategy at GSL is to lock in longer-term charters whenever the economics in the market are right, and we've done that with some ships, and we've just actually concluded a couple of other charters, not in time for our earnings release, but we've put the information up on our website. And just to give you a sense of that, we've fixed a Panamax Max container ship, a 5,100 TEU container ship, at a rate which is 3.5 times the rate that at which the same ship was fixed back in the second quarter of this year. So she was fixed back in the second quarter at $7,000 a day, and she's just been fixed at $24,500 a day. So that gives you a sense of the very real uptick that we're seeing in the market, and the fact that we're actually jumping on those opportunities to lock in attractive charters. Similarly, we've just fixed a feeder ship, which, you know, her sisters were being fixed at roughly $6,500 a day back in the second quarter, and we've just fixed her for $12,850 a day. So those are sort of dollar examples of the sort of value that's beginning to crystallize in the market.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting improvement, and as you mentioned, some of the rates have more than doubled. I mean, you know, I think on the Q3 call that just happened, you know, your earnings expectations, they exceeded mine, they exceeded consensus, the earnings themselves were good, but there's a little bit less charter rolls than maybe we had hoped to see. How many charter rolls do you think you're going to be negotiating during Q4? Is it like five or six more, or how many until maybe January?
Well, it would have been four more, but the two that I've just mentioned to you are two of those four. So there's only really a couple left this year. But if we look at now through the end of the first half of 2021, there are roughly nine ships left to charter in the market when they come open.
All right, so it looks like two down at very good rates, and two more for Q4, and then the rest of it, of course, will be Q1 and Q2. All right, that makes sense. Any other kind of a big picture market views or risk factors that investors should be considering as we enter 2021?
No, I would say that, I mean, if we look into the picture from a more detailed, because we like that always to be more detailed than the general pictures. What we see right now is the number two liner company acquiring ships in a very big pace. I mean, they're buying anything that floats with boxes on top. That, to me, being in this industry for more than 20 years, means a lot. What I see that's going on, I mean, the liner companies have realized that ordering ships is going to ruin what they have created, which is this fantastic freight rates environment. So I think that they are very cautious not to go and order ships, given also the challenge, the technical challenges I just mentioned before about the fuel of the future. Now, in the nature of the beast, though, is that, you know, these guys are competitive. They're competitive animals, liner companies. So they always want to try to take some from the others and increase the profitability and so on and so forth. So I think that what I can read between the lines is that liner company that is so shrewd in over the years in secondhand arena, they're taking ships that others have today on charter. So, you know, in the next year, you know, a lot of ships that belong to, you know, were under charter to other liner companies are going to be under their control, and therefore these other liner companies are going to miss capacity. And given the fact that we have a specific pool of existing ships that they can only take ships, what I can imagine is that the liner companies will go after ships more aggressively to cover the shortages that will be created by the acquisitions of this competitor. And that will only help the market grow higher, in my view.
Yeah, the dearth of new builds has been something we've really watched. And of course, Panamax, the midsize and the post-Panamax had been a sector that I think most liner companies, investors, analysts had sort of written off, right? It's sort of obsolete tonnage. It's not going to get any business. And now it's one of the hottest areas in the market. And the order book is zero. So, you know, we're really optimistic about that. And it seems like there's a lot more developing regional trade. And I know in your slides, you mentioned like the high reefer capacity and stuff like that. Do you think that this sort of Panamax and post-Panamax trade will continue to grow? Or do you think it's primarily just a result of the lack of supply? Like, is this demand driven? Like, is there more demand for this segment? Or is it mainly just supplies falling off?
Well, we always believed into the post-Panamaxes are wider than Panamaxes, quite substantially. A Panamax ship is 32 meters wide, a post-Panamax is 40 meters and more, 40 to 50 meters, let's say, wide. Now, as the ships become wider, it's an exponential relationship, not a linear, of their carrying cargo, of their cargo carrying capacity. So the wider ship can carry substantially more cargo than the narrower ship. Therefore, the post-Panamaxes offer the lowest slot cost of ships. So we always believed in that. Liner companies did believe in those ships as well, I have to say, and that's why they have been employing them for over the years. Analysts did not believe in them because from a simplistic way of looking things, you read about orders of 20,000 TEU ships, you read about orders of 14,000 TEU ships, and then obviously you think, okay, these big ships is the future. You know, the smaller ships are all together not necessarily the same, which you need to go into very deep details of our market to realize that is not the case, has never been the case. Now, on Panamaxes, that's a different category. Panamaxes are becoming the feeders of the future. I mean, feeders, when we heard about this feeder story all these years, and people were talking about ships anything between 1,000 boxes all the way to 3.5. Now feeders are becoming bigger. They're becoming 4.5, 5,000 TEU ships. So again, Panamaxes, they used to be in the old days main haul ships, but now they are becoming feeders. There was a time that they were in between. There was no use for them because they were too big to be feeders and too small to be main haul ships. But as things evolved and as cargoes improved and increased, now Panamaxes have found their position, which is, you know, the big feeders of today. Post-Panamaxes are regional traders, main haul traders, feeders. They can do everything depending on the trade, depending on the cargo volumes. But these ships always, anytime you compare a Panamax or a post-Panamax, the winner is the post-Panamax simply because they offer 50% usually more cargo volume comparing similar size ships. So therefore, the slot cost is substantially lower.
Yes, certainly. And one thing, Jay, we haven't touched upon yet today, maybe you're about to, is ESG. And ESG is something that is increasingly coming to the fore, you know, not only in the eyes of investors, but also in the eyes of the industry itself. And as intuitively you would imagine, there's a very tight correlation between fuel burned per box carried and emissions per box carried. And clearly, there's a very strong inverse relationship between size and emissions per box carried. So the further you move up the size categories, the better from both a fuel burn and emissions production per cargo slot. And so what we're seeing in the post-Panamaxes, as George says, is they sit at the sweet spot of maximum operational flexibility because they can be deployed pretty much anywhere, and low fuel and low emissions per slot, and as a result, low costs per slot the liner operations themselves.
Yeah, certainly some economies of scale that you might not think at first, because I think the initial point or initial viewpoint of the market was that the scale just kept going up and up and up, and you had to get to these 20,000 TEU vessels. But we're seeing that there's a huge demand for these mid-size vessels that have more modern designs, are more efficient, and have the wider berth, but also and have reefer plugs and whatnot, but aren't quite as large, right? Because once you get into like that 18,000, 20,000 TEU tonnage, you're excluding a lot of the developing ports and whatnot.
That's absolutely right, Jay. And just to sort of underline that point further, you know, the really big ships, the 23,000 TEU ships that you talked about, are effectively captive to the big east-west arterial trades, primarily the Asia-Europe trades, whereas the mid-sized post-Panamaxes that we're focused upon can be deployed pretty much anywhere in the world. And it's important to mention that, you know, despite the fact that it's the Trans-Pacific and Asia-Europe trades that hit all of the headlines, over 70% of global containerized trade volumes are actually in non-mainland trades. They're in intra-regional trades, intermediate trades, north-south trades, trades falling outside the envelope of those that can be serviced by those really big ships.
I suppose it also depends if you split it up by actual trade voyages as opposed to TEU capacity, right? Because if you split it up by TEU capacity, then the larger ships, right, disproportionately represented, because one 20,000 TEU ship is equivalent to five Panamaxes that are doing voyages.
Yes.
So I suppose the statistics they get thrown around are probably misleading as well, right? Because they would skew towards suggesting that maybe the higher TEU ships have more volume, and they do have more volume in terms of the number of boxes, but not maybe more volume in terms of the number of voyages, which is important to remember.
And there is also a trend for, let's say, more regular lines instead of just loading and very huge 23,000 TEU vessels and have once per week. For a number of reasons. E-commerce, now with the COVID, for a number of reasons.
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of that in the Pacific, right? There's been those expedited US-China lines that have been doing offering higher speed delivery. And of course, those evolve
exactly
into smaller tonnage. So yeah, I think a pretty useful call today. The one thing, and I know we've already hit it and we're kind of, you know, beating a dead horse a little bit at this point, but the number one thing that folks are watching with GSL is that refinancing, and then of course the dividend, ideally after the refinancing. I know you can't provide specific guidance. I know we've kind of already hit this question a little bit, but is sort of like a mid-21, assuming COVID gets handled and the vaccines are effective, is sort of a mid-21 timeline reasonable, or do we think it's going to be even further at this point?
I think we would be extremely disappointed if we weren't able to get something done before the middle of next year.
Okay, that's good to hear, just to see your sentiment, because I know we're on the cusp of it. We've been on the cusp of it for a while. It's just a matter of lining up all the parties and getting past the COVID overhang. So with that said, thank you everyone for joining us today. We appreciate your time. This concludes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We just hosted the Global Ship Lease Management, stock symbol GSL. As a disclosure, I have a long position in GSL. Nothing you heard on the call today constitutes official investment advice or company guidance in any form. This was recorded on the morning of 12 November 2020 at about 10 a.m. Eastern.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Jay Mintzmyer runs the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Value Investor's Edge there.